Okay, I think we can start now. So we're gonna have two talks. First by Mitchell on the SMC, and then rotation first by Laura.
After the discussion.
After the discussion, they'll merge the discussion, trust me.
There'll be a seamless, you know,
transition.
I wanted to talk just briefly about some new work on the SMC, and this is the SMC LMC system shown in H1. This is the Milky Way, and you know, still no stars associated with this H1 stream. But we think that it's because you need deeper imaging. There should be stars associated with that stream. But anyway, just so you know, it's still just an H1 stream. I, however, will be talking about the stars, not the H1. And then Laura is actually going to talk about H1 rotation curves. So, you know, two different tracers there.
And why do you think there should be stars?
Well, if our model that if it is indeed a tidal interaction between the LMC and the SMC is correct.
So the old picture, going back to Donald Lindenbell and Doug Lynn's thesis with Lindenbell, was that in fact it was the Milky Way that tidally disturbed the system and pulled out the stars and the gas. And the fact that stars were not seen and apparently still haven't been seen was a fatal blow to that.
Agreed. And so now, for us, it's...
It now seems that the LMC SMC is on their first passage. And
right.
They've been going around for some time, which was the old picture.
Exactly. So our model is the same, except what's the actual driver is that the LMC is tidally disrupting the SMC. And so similarly, if no stars are found, it will be a blow to our picture as well. But the change was motivated by the fact that we think they're coming in for the first time.
So, we've got a curiosity. The fluff that's the LMC.
Yeah.
What is the idea there?
Well, so, I mean, this, you know, perhaps if you look at different people's data sets, it looks a little bit different, but this is called a leading arm. And the idea is that it is a, you know, leading. Yeah, so it is the case that the leading part of the stream is more tenuous than the trailing, right? So there have been. You know, other models that this is just a ground pressure stripping effect. But this is called a leading arm, yes.
is it there in your models too?
It is. There is a leading arm in the models, and because the orbital setup is actually the LMC-SMC orbital plane as opposed to the LMC-Milky Way orbital plane, it does look a little screwy. So that may be explaining a little bit why in this picture it looks weird. But I think a more detailed hydrodynamic one should be done. I should say that...
So which part is closest to this in the model?
Of this, there is a distance gradient.
Yeah, which bit's closest to the sun?
That's a good question. I think we concentrated mostly looking at the trailing bit. So between the leading and the trailing, I'm not actually sure.
Presumably it would be easier to see the stars in the closest
part. Right. Yes.
Is there any H-alpha?
There is.
Okay.
And those are measurements done by Fox et al. Mm-hmm. And when you add up the total baryon budget, there's actually, you know, quite a lot of masses in this system.
If it's on the first passage, the leading arm should be the closer one.
Right. So. Yes. Well.
No.
That. I mean,
the. It's very close to person.
Yeah.
It's coming out.
Again, the orbital plane is set by LMC-SMC, so, but maybe slightly complicated, but I would tend to agree with you. I can look at if they actually plotted the leading bit as a function of distance. But yeah, I'm sure that Bettina has that plot, I think. Should say that all this work is being done by my graduate student, Paul Zibuk. That's Paul. So I'm not going to go into too many details, so I apologize. There's quite a few new faces. Just please feel free to ask me if I'm saying jargon that has not been explained. But the way we do this is that we have been using quasars that are, you know, at high enough redshift behind both clouds that they provide our inertial reference frame. And by the way, when I say do this, I mean the way that we've been trying to measure the tangential motions of the clouds, the proper motions, is using that as a background reference frame. Reason for that choice was multifold, but you could also use background galaxies that were point-like, for example. But we're using quasars for various reasons. This is what we had for the LMC. You can ignore the color here, but each of the colored symbols is the location of a quasar. This is an R-band image in both cases, and again, you can ignore the boxes. That's just showing the Macho photometric coverage where these quasars were actually found in the Macho database from their optical variability, but then they were also followed up spectroscopically to confirm that they were quasars. And that was done by Mala. This is about 22 different sort of pencil beams then through the LMC. And the Hubble, what we used to measure the tangential motions was the Hubble Space Telescope. The Hubble Space Telescope field of view is not a whole lot bigger than the size of these circles, these symbols. So again, what we have is, you know, pencil beams through the LMC. And so you have to think about, you know, if you measure a proper motion for the LMC, the foreground LMC stars with respect to this quasar, you have to think about how you then take this signal and turn it into a center of mass motion, say. For the SMC we had, but you know, again, it's 22 different pencil beams, so you know, you can assume that we have some good coverage and take an average to get center of mass. In the case of the SMC, we had much fewer quasars. So given that these are probably, you know, quite, you know, complicated dynamical systems, we weren't able to look in any great detail into the internal motions, let alone the central mass motion of the SMC. So just very briefly for the LMC, just again showing you those 22 different quasar fields, and at the location of each quasar field, I'm also showing you a CMD, okay, for the LMC. So just so you know, you know, each field actually gives us quite a lot of information. You can see that there are some, you know, exclusively older fields, some fields with, you know, both main sequence and evolved stars. You know, there's quite a lot of information that we could get at that goes beyond just center of mass motion. But anyway, I'm not going to talk about center of mass motion. I'm actually going to subtract the central mass motion and look at what this data tells us for the internal motion. Okay, so I've subtracted off the absolute motion and this is the residual. Again, this is the LMC. The center, the dynamical center, is somewhere in the middle there. It's something you could fit from this data.
Is this already corrected for the perspective effect?
This has been corrected for the perspective effect. So, one correction that Simon's talking about when we go from, you know, just these raw data points to something like a center of mass motion is that, you know, these fields are separated by real degrees. And so at each point, there's varying contributions from the line of sight velocity and the tangential motion. So if you remove that line of sight velocity term, you just call that a geometric term, that has been done in this plot. And so what's left is other residual motions in the LMC, and hopefully you can see clockwise rotation. Okay, so the residual signal starts at the point, and then the square is telling you the size of the error bar. And you can again ignore the color, unimportant things.
What's the order of magnitude of those proper motions?
So these residuals. So now if you decompose this into, you know, parallel perpendicular and trying to actually plot a rotation curve from this, That this is what you get again for the LMC. Okay, so this is in milliard second per year, but this is in kilometers per second.
This is before the Sinai or after the Sinai?
This is after the Sinai. So everything has been now fit to that previous set of vectors.
The biggest uncertainty in Sinai,
exactly.
So it's, I forget the exact value, but it does matter. The uncertainty is actually, but we were actually able to fit I much better than from line of sight velocity work because we have these two, that we have both two components of that. We have two components, but it's 30 degrees, and I want to say I is 30 degrees, and I want to say that the error is something like 0.2 or 0.5 degrees.
What? Really?
Oh, sorry. Something like 10 degrees. Sorry.
In your previous picture, there were two different colors, red and green.
Right. Those.
2F and 3F.
Yes, that's right. So this is depending on whether we had, you know, two epochs of data from HST or three.
There's no particular reason to expect it to be flat, right, given the
Coast
of Milky Way and there's all these huge effects.
Exactly. All we, this is just an assumption in our modeling that the full model had seven parameters, you know, the dynamical center. A rotation curve that just rising up to a point and then flat beyond. And then other things like theta and I. And
you're assuming it's not warped, is that right?
Assuming that it's, yeah. I mean, you know, we do iteratively fit to the residuals. Yeah. But we don't need a warp to actually, we didn't need, you know, more parameters to use. Yeah, that's physical, yeah.
So how big is the bar, you know what I'm saying?
Most of it, right? Yeah, it's quite large, but I guess we could try to estimate.
In principle, you wouldn't even get a much worse as you just fit a small bike.
Yeah.
Most of the mass seems to be there.
So what we can do is, you know, get an enclosed mass from this. So the rotation curve here is about 90 kilometers per second. It's actually consistent with the H1 rotation curve in this case. And, you know, this actually goes out till about 8 kiloparsecs, and that's the enclosed mass. But only up to 8 kiloparsecs. So this is what we were able to do for the LMC. I will say that each of these individual points, the error bars, in the best case, we're getting to below 20 kilometers per second. Okay, but that's actually averaging over star, many stars, it's not a per star error. And I'll just point out that, you know, all the action that, you know, people are interested in, although there's been a new, you know, in what Laura's going to talk about, they're proposing looking at a different area perhaps, but, you know, this core or cusp, which LMC is probably not the best system to look at that, but that would be within this inner kiloparsec, say, and, you know, we only have actually sort of one data point there present. Yes.
How does the closed mass compare with the stellar mass?
So the stellar mass is, again, within a similar radius, is about 8 kiloparsecs. It's 3 times 10 to the 9.
Oh. So it's already mostly dark matter?
Yes, so it is dark matter dominant.
And what's the half-life radius,
roughly?
How many half-life radii are you out?
Yeah.
I think it's like
1 kpc. It's like 1 kpc, 1.5 or something
that's
like that.
That's what T0 is here, isn't it? Isn't
that
all
memories? Yeah, it's like
1,
yeah.
Well, what's the gas construction? It could easily be 40-50%.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right.
It's not that roughly.
That's a fair point. Yeah.
Okay, so.
That's a fair point.
And the stellar mass you said is.
3 times 10 to the 9.
And let's suppose that there's a lot of gas, maybe that's 5 times 10 to the 9. But still, that's now 17 times 10 to the 9. So.
Right.
That's still most of everything.
So the aim now is, you know, can we do something like this for the SMC? And I will say that, you know, so the clouds are coming in for the first time, we think. And I would say that the most interesting thing about them is their masses. Because, you know, if the LMC, as we think, is getting actually quite big, you know, 10 to the 11, And the Milky Way is getting kind of small, you know, 10 to the 12. So, you know, if this is the case, I mean, this is almost, you know, major collision territory. And you can't really ignore these, the system, if, you know, if you're trying to do some sort of dynamical modeling of the Milky Way. So, but anyway, this is the extent of the data at present. But
is the data good enough to say anything about the Bose dispersion?
We could. Yes, it's definitely consistent with being rotation supported. So V is much bigger than sigma. Sigma is sort of population dependent. So, you know, the old stars have a higher sigma, but that's still a lot less than the rotation velocity that we're measuring. And if you take an average, like the, you know, carbon stars, that sigma is like 20 to 30 kilometers per second. So it's, you know, definitely consistent with being a rotation supported.
And in the model, where is the expected tidal radius for them?
I would something. It should be something like 10 kiloparsecs, I would say. It should be something like a tenth of its distance, right?
Because the ratio of both to the Milky Way.
So that's about 10.
It's twice the radial extent that you showed on the previous plot.
Yeah. Yes.
Went out to 8, didn't you?
Went out to 8.
Well, yours was
mine is going out to 5 in that plot. But, okay. So, now, as I said, we only had those 5. In that previous study, we only had these yellow locations for quasars for the SMC, but this is now what we have. There's a new set of quasars. We have 13 total new ones shown in red, and this is work that was done by Simon Kozlowski and Krzysztof Czanek, and it's using OVO, and then again following up spectroscopically. So we put in a new proposal with HST to do the SMC now in some detail. Okay, so without further ado, I will show you some, as far as we got, like till half an hour ago. just getting there. Hopefully you'll find it interesting. So, sorry we weren't able to overplot. my student was trying to do this. He did manage for the residuals, but this is the absolute. Okay, so the location of these vectors should be, you know, think of it as one of those locations of the quasars. Okay, so this is now the absolute proper motion measurement for each of these fields. Okay, and the new ones are shown in black. Okay, so that's Paul's work. And we're also plotting old work. Okay, so my old work shown in red. There's a Vista proper motion measurement from Cioni et al. Shown in green. And then there's a Gaia to Hipparchos proper motion estimate. And this is actually for individual stars, relatively bright ones shown in blue.
Where's the LMC?
Yeah, so I can actually jump ahead. I'll show you that. Sorry. That's the LMC. So this was the SMC that I was showing you. So that's LMC. Okay, this is again the absolute motions for each of the clouds. So we get a new, take the error bars with a grain of salt here. I actually think they're going to come down because here I'm only plotting as measured. I haven't actually taken into account the viewing perspective and all that. So that should tighten things up. Okay, but this is how the LMC and the SMC are moving in the plane of the sky. Okay, the relative velocity is about 110 kilometers per second.
That's two clouds.
Between the two, and this is, you know, galactocentric. So I would say it's come down a little bit than, you know, like back in 2006. So this, I would say that it's slightly more comfortably bound. It would be easier to keep them bound, I think. But still, you know, it's a fairly high relative velocity.
Is it 3D?
Or? That's 3D.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean, galactocentric?
So I've taken, the proper motion, you know, and the line of sight velocity, and shifted into a galactocentric system.
Relative velocity, yes.
Oh yeah, relative velocity could be, yeah, but still it's 3D. It's not just, you know, proper motion minus proper motion. Yes, so relative velocity will matter. So this is how they move in respect to each other. So I think, you know, I think we can get better estimate. The plan would be to get a better estimate of SMC mass now. Okay, so this, now this is galactocentric. So the total velocity of the SMC is 255 from this new data. Again, it's, you know, as you can see, it's actually all very consistent with the old work.
And that's the velocity with respect to the center of the Milky Way.
With respect to the center of the Milky Way. And the LMC for comparison is something like 321 or so. And, but, so we can do the same thing now. We can subtract this, just an average. So again, it's just doing the dumbest thing, is taking an average of this and subtracting it. These are the residuals. I'm sorry, there's a little bit of a shift. But it's mostly correct. We need to be shifted a little bit this way. Paul was working on this earlier. But it mostly works. So this is the, these are now the residuals. So at first glance, it looks like a total mess. Okay, and the current thinking is that, you know, LMC, rotation supported, you know, disk, all this. Current thinking is that SMC is dispersion supported, so it's a dwarf spheroidal, but with gaps. And if you, so if you look at line of sight velocity work, this is Harrison Zawitzki and also Knut Olsen have been doing, you know, line of sight velocity surveys. There's no real evidence for rotation in the RGB stars. It's less than 17 kilometers per second at best. Okay, whereas sigma for the SMC is quite a bit larger, again for that same population, more like 30 kilometers per second. Okay, so sigma, current thinking is that it's larger than V. The gas does show some rotation, an amplitude of about 40 kilometers per second. And then the young stars like A stars and O stars and B stars, they show some tentative hints of rotation as well. But, you know, the bulk of the stars show, at least it's only the inner bit that's been surveyed. Now, in our models, in Rutina's model, she is able to actually wipe out some rotation in the center while maintaining rotation in the stellar component in the outskirts. So anyway, this at first glance looks like a total mess, but I'm thinking I see some rotation actually.
All the ones on the bottom are going this way.
Yeah, and
most of the ones on the top are going that way.
And again, this is
some side with the
side. There's some, yeah. And so again, the LMC is here. So,
just a technical question, right?
Yeah.
Because in every field, you have basically only one quasar.
Yes, only one quasar.
So how do you know where the orientation, the angular orientation, expected at that one reference point?
So everything is so the.
If you make an error in that, it would show up as a. After you take out the net motion, it would show up as a net vector.
Well, so the quasar and the stars, right? So we have like, say, we have two epochs, right? And so you have, you know, at one time, here's the quasar. Here are LMC or SMC stars. Okay, and then we wait, in this case, 3 years. Okay, and we took another image. Okay, and so here's the quasar again, and then, like, you know, there might be some rotation and such, as you say, of the camera, right? So there may be rotation, there may be, you know, other effects, stretching, skew, you know, this is in space, so there are actually thermal differences, you know, all that stuff. So what we do to set the what we do is that we want some zero point. Right, and to set that zero, we actually transform all the stars. Okay, I'm going to put the wrong arrow on them, but you get the idea. You want to take the right star and actually find a transformation for it into the earlier epoch. And you could do it either way. And the reason that we use the stars to get to zero is because we have a lot of stars in the field, and so we have a better handle on what could be complicated transformation terms. And then we use that same transformation to transform the quasar once we've actually found the transformation terms. And so even though it's...
Doesn't that, yeah. that the first order assume no?
No, but rotation is one of the terms.
It's really small fields, so the lowest order is just solving for the motion of the quasar relative to the stars.
That's
terms.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that is one of the terms in the transformation.
Can you break your sample of stars? So you use the mean velocity for the whole field with lots of stars, right?
Right.
And can you break it into samples of two and get an idea of the internal velocity dispersion?
Yeah, we're trying that now. He said first, so I'm having Paul look at, you know, just the main sequence versus the red giant brand, so just a color cut. And we could look for, again, population dependent dispersion, see if, you know, young versus old give, you know, interesting results. But we're in the process of doing that. But we do have enough signal to do that. Roughly have, you know, hundreds or more stars in a given field. So again, I'm you know, perhaps actually this is detection. I say this very, you know, tentatively that, you know, maybe there is some rotation, stellar rotation in the SMC. And just so you know, that the largest residual here is, you know, it's a magnitude of about 65 kilometers per second from the, this is again central mass motion having been subtracted. So this is a, you know, this is, these are quite large velocities. This is a little bit unfair because again, we haven't taken into account that viewing perspective term here, so it will get smaller. But I would say that if there is rotation, it will be smaller than this, but it is actually maybe a little bit more consistent with the gas, which is at about 40 kilometers per second.
So if you were to fit rotation, would you do it as a constant rotation velocity or as a solid body rotation with constant angular speed? What's more consistent with the data?
I haven't tried that yet.
But
I don't actually know.
It's probably hard to do it anymore.
Do it by
eye. So you have two ideas, constant velocity, constant angular speed, and see which one is more consistent.
Well, you did something like that for the LMC.
Yeah, so that was just, yeah, that was just assumed, yes. And, you know, that was, our chi-squares were, you know,
right.
It didn't seem to be any decision
well,
to add so more.
With the LMC, there was a dramatically improved three epoch.
Right, so this.
With only two epochs, your LMC also would have been pretty terrible.
Printed, yeah, true, good point.
And this is just two epochs.
Yeah, it's slightly better because it's like 3 years as opposed to a two-year baseline, but, but yeah, so perhaps, you know, there was some talk about how you go from one type of galaxy to another, right? Dwarf irregulars to dwarf spherical, say there's this idea that, you know, there's potentially a pathway via harassment, but, you know, definitely the SMC, if this rotation holds up, then it's definitely on the cusp of going from a, you know, disk system to a, perhaps.
And you get another epoch from Gaia, effectively?
Yeah, so in fact, we can we don't get another epoch as yet, but there is a Gaia only, so we won't need to be tied to Hipparchos, which is very bright. There is a Gaia epoch that's actually quite close to our second epoch, and we are currently folding that into our analysis. It won't be like three epochs like we have for the LMC because the two at the end are very close together, but it will provide a different check. And then as of April, next April, there'll be a new release. It's still a little bit close to our, you know, second epoch, but, you know, in terms of checks. And we're working on that right now. And Paul is close to getting HST to Gaia proper motion. I will stop there.
So a quick question on the LMC. The LMC was had this problem with the monic center being sort of in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
I mean, so
yeah.
Was this
was like, this was a, we determined from the fit.
From your own
data? Yes, from our own data, so we determined from
that
this.
That coincides with the one that you see in the gas?
It now coincides extremely well with the one we see in the gas. Not necessarily expected, but you know, there used to be this the controversy about the fact that there
were
the
gas and the bar exactly. is not aligned.
The cellar bar is not aligned with the dynamical center. So the bar is definitely offset.
Circular motion
starts
particularly like exactly.
What can I imagine a bar that's upset from the center? But so, in Gucina's model, it is short-lived, but she does get off-center bars if the SMC has plowed through the LMC.
So our models, the SMC has actually been through the LMC?
Yes, it has actually been through the LMC. And she, you know, we haven't done any comparison yet, obviously, because we just saw this morning, but, you know, she does have still, despite that, rotation in the outskirts. So, you know, some semblance is maintained at least.
There used to be claims that the LMC was much more extensive in depth than it is on the skies. Is that still true, or is that gone away?
It is.
You said it's been an extension of 30 degrees.
Yeah.
No. I mean,
no, he means line of sight.
It's like projecting staring at us.
Yeah, so I think that's still. So for the LMC, I thought it was more that there was, you know, like a stellar halo sort of Michael Lensing situation going on. But the SMC people have argued that it is, you know, very extended along the line of sight and just literally staring down the barrel. And so the other thing I'm having Paul do is see if we can actually, from, you know, we have those CMDs, if we can actually fit distances just to see if we can get a line of sight depth. But yeah, it's at least 8 kiloparsecs, the depth already from like overall data and stuff like that. And that's, this is, yeah, this distance, a degree is about a kiloparsec. So it is at least as extended as what we're seeing. Yeah.
So you said earlier that the SMC LMC relative velocity is about 110 kilometers per second. If you look at the projection, does it look like the vector is actually pointing back toward the opposite direction from the LMC? I mean, does it look like they're separating, having gone through each other?
See what I'm asking? Yeah, I do see what you're asking.
Maybe correct me for some gravitational effect of the Milky Way.
Yeah, I would have to do that, what this means. This is just as measured.
Right, but that would be a very interesting thing to do with the test.
Definitely.
Your Tina Bestless model.
Yeah. But we can do that.
How is the distance of the SMC and the LMC?
Again, you know, it's all changing, right? Because, you know, traditionally, the SMC is at about 62 and the LMC is at about 50 kiloparsecs, but now both of them, as Simon's saying, you know, there is quite a lot of line of sight depth. But, yeah, again, traditionally SMC is further.
For a long time, 10 years ago at least, the LMC distance was the single biggest uncertainty in the cosmic distance ladder.
Right.
Has that improved any, or now an even bigger issue, or what's going on with that?
So LMC depth hasn't been coming up a bunch lately since the Michael Lensing results. You know, I think people have not been. I haven't seen any new papers about it, but you know the. The distance that everyone uses is from that Hubble Key project, Friedman et al. And I think the distance error in the distance modulus is about 0.1 or 0.2 from that. And that's still what everyone uses.
They were supposed to improve by now using eclipsing binaries, which should be able to give an absolute distance. That was the claim 10 years ago.
There's also an R library project.
Well, actually,
which is supposed to give 2% distances per R library if you go into the infrared. So that might be a potential improvement as well. I haven't seen results yet, though.
Again, making a unified one of the whole thing becomes a lot of us.
Yeah, I agree. So from stars to guests.
I don't know why you made that comment. Right, so this is the paper that appeared on AstroPH, I think, on Monday or sometime this week. And it was suggested on complementary, maybe, or at least slightly related to DTS talk today. So that's how I ended up choosing this to discuss. It is not my work, so if there are two technical questions, I may not be able to answer it fully. And it is about the interpretation of rotation curves in dwarf galaxies. Just a little bit of context. So this paper comes after a different paper by the same team that appeared about 1 year ago or a little bit more. So Kyle Omen is a PhD student in the University of Victoria. What he was saying is, this is all related to the cusp versus core controversy in rotation curves. And so the literature had gone forever in the topic. And so the new perspective of this people is like, it's not whether it is an NFW or it is a core profile. It is the fact that you find everything, all kind of variety. So these are observations of dwarfs that are selected to have the same sort of terminal velocity around 80 kilometers per second. So in principle, all these objects are of comparable mass. But what you have to look at, so the dots are the observations, is the shapes of these curves is very different. They all end up somewhere around 80, but some rise up very quickly, and then they settle into something flat. Whereas other things, like IC2574, they rise up like way more slowly, and then they reach the 80 kilometers per second. So the controversy is not whether this is or it is not an NFW profile, but the fact that you can find all this variety of shapes. So after this paper appeared, a lot of people jumped to work in the problem. They found some explanations. Some of them said, for example, feedback can explain this. Feedback can, in some cases, create these cores by stirversy episodes of star formation that would change the central potential, that would somehow create a core in the center. But such problems would have issues in explaining these other cases in which, instead of forming a core, you have something that is even steeper than an NFW profile. Some other explanation out there was put out by us, and that's, so Peter is coming up next week. He's a postdoc at UCR, and this one involves saying, well, maybe dark matter is self-interacting, and if you take into account the contribution of the variance, you might also be able to create such diversity.
Can I ask you, sure. So is this, because I saw this, is it really the circle velocity or is this a rotation velocity?
This is what, it is measured, is a rotation velocity, right. So exactly, so the new paper addresses that transition.
Thing, right?
So. Exactly. So what the new paper is now doing in a much more careful way is to say, well, V-rot will not always be V-circ, all right? And it is done in a more careful way than before by actually taking the numerical simulations where you know by definition which is V-circ and making mock observations, H1 observations of these galaxies, creating the full velocity data cube, and then applying the same software that the observers use with real galaxies, which is a version of the tilted ring model. Right? So what they go on to show is first, so they use this simulation called the Apostle simulation, which is just a mimic of the local group. So as part of the M31 and Milky Way pair, they also get a bunch of dwarfs around that are in the field. So they are taking those.
And they show just general properties of these galaxies. They just show that they more or less fit the baryonic Tally Fissure. They have the right amount of gas and more or less the right sizes. So that means that they can use these objects as analogs of whatever is observed. They go into very much detail on how they create these velocity data cubes that I will kind of skip. But they try to do a good job. They choose some inclination, and then they take velocity channels, and they sort of mimic what the observers get in H1. Let me see what we can look at. Right, so this is what Rob was mentioning. So this is...
Why don't you show the data first? I mean, I skipped over what the data actually looked like.
Oh, but this is...
Next one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right, so these are the marks that they created. This is the projection, density projection of the H1, just to show sort of how much they extend. Then you can get kinematics, right? This it looks like they are rotating because they sort of are. And then they can subtract that and get the velocity dispersion maps from these objects. Basically, the modeling of this is what they what ends up giving you the rotation curves of these objects. Right, this is all, I believe this is all simulations.
Let me see. Apostle, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. These are all simulated maps. Right, there's no real data here.
Some observed maps, then.
Right. So the first thing they do is, before applying the tilted ring model, they do an easier comparison first. Is everyone familiar with tilted ring model is? It's basically assuming that your galaxy is composed of different rings. And then what you do is you fit the rotation of this, these maps by assuming it's a collection of rings, and then each ring is able to rotate and it has its own position angle, inclination, and velocity, and velocity dispersion. So it gives you a lot of parameters per ring that you assume in your model. So that's how most of our rotation curves are actually computed. But before going to that, they make it...
They don't have any radial motion, so it's all time.
They assume, exactly, that there are no radial motions. So H1 is supposed to be in circular velocities. All right, and that is the key of the disagreement that will be shown later. So if you just take...
They select the center from the data as an observer would do without
exactly.
anything prior.
They do check, though. Right, so they select it as the densest pair of pixels. But they do check that it is always very close to the center of the potential given by subfine, the gravitational potential. Oh no, but you can say that at least for these simulated galaxies it is okay. Right, so the centers doesn't seem to be much of a problem. Now, so what you see over here is what Rob was saying, the dark in the top row, you have the very, the thick dark line is the circular velocity as computed by using all the mass in the simulation in spherical beams. Now, in gray, what you get is what you could infer from these maps. All right, if you make an azimuthal average around in your maps, okay? Just taking it as it comes.
So without any inclination correction? No inclination correction.
They are correcting by inclination. They know inclination.
Ellipse, not around the circle.
Right, it's correct. Yeah, sorry. Mm-hmm. But they are not allowing each ellipse to be different. They just did it. And then they also consider corrections by gas pressure support, right? Because that can be important. And so that is the difference between the two gray lines. There is a thick gray line and a thin gray line. The thick one includes pressure support. And so what they do is, as an observer would do, cases in which these two velocities are quite different, then they will remove it from the sample, assuming that they are not really in equilibrium. But they will keep most of the objects in which that difference is not big. In this case, they will throw away this one, but we'll keep this two. That's the first correction. All right, so now it comes the part in which they go and apply the same software that observers use for deriving this from the observations. And this is what they get for exactly...
Sorry, can you repeat that? That's the reference part.
Right, I can...
So what? They just add...
Right, so this. So that you assume that the circular velocity is whatever you measure as rotation velocity, and you correct by pressure support, which in observations is done by assuming, by applying the formula. It depends on the velocity dispersion and on the surface density of the gas. Actually, on the gradient of that.
These are from the observed quantities.
And this is all from the observed quantities that were shown here in the other graph that we didn't explain. So this is the velocity dispersion as a function of radius, and this is the surface density. So you compute all that, and then you apply the correction, and if that ends up at, I think, it's at the given radius, 2 kpc being more than 15% correction, they throw away that galaxy.
So I have seen people do it, but I've never seen.
No, they do it as.
But it stays with the same magnitude of large radii.
I wouldn't know why.
Normally, it's only when the rotation is rising that it makes a difference, or not.
Sigma is also rising here.
No, I'm mainly talking about the difference between the thick and the thin gray line.
Yeah, I understand.
That stays about the same at every radius.
Well, for example, in the Genzel Nature paper for the higher energy galaxies, this correction was much larger, and that actually changed what was appeared to be strongly falling rotation curves to things which were only mildly falling.
At large radius.
At large radius.
So, in effect, at large radius, the correction.
But their correction was much bigger than we're talking about here.
Exactly. It's still 12 grams per second. Yeah. Mostly that's just thermal, because then the four Kelvin gives you.
Just a little bit, yeah. I think they just do it as a way of removing objects that could be more difficult to interpret. They said, let's keep the best cases. Yeah, that cuts down almost to half their sample. Let me show you.
Actually, throw half the sample away.
You see? So the dark and the gray, those are all simulations. The gray ones are the ones that they will throw away. And they keep only the dark dots.
You should have shown results about those.
Here. Yeah, but then not in the kinematical analysis anymore.
Well, I guess
that's
what you're
using. Right. Good. So now they go on using this MUX over here to apply the tilted ring model and recover a rotation curve based on that. And so for this, remember from these three panels that we see here, then we keep these two and remove this one. So we are going to see what happens for these two over there. And this is what you get. So again, the dark line is the measured circular velocity in the simulation. And now red and blue are two different circular velocities that you obtain from, rotation velocities that you obtained from applying the tilted ring model, assuming different viewing angles. Because once, so you can fix the inclination, but you still have freedom to see which is your line of sight in the simulation, right? So if you rotate it differently, in this case they chose these two because they just maximize the difference, you can get for exactly the same galaxy that something that looks like the red curve or something that looks like the blue curve, which are clearly very different. If you were to observe this galaxy from the blue one, you would conclude that this galaxy has a core, a massive core that goes all the way to, let me see this scale here, 6 to 8 kpc. Right? Whereas if you observe it from the right angle, you will get the red one and you will say that it's an LFW.
So how do you determine what's the right angle? Because actually, this is a simulation, so you have the data. So you can determine what the correct plane is.
There is no right
plane. Only if you know whether it's an NFW or a core.
This galaxy is an NFW, right? So it has the true velocity is the black line. Now, the other one, there is no correct angle. So you fix the inclination. The inclination is fixed for both curves. But you can rotate your galaxy like this and then incline it, right? So that's what they are actually changing here.
Restoring the location of the observers.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
But the inclination is the same.
The inclination is exactly the same. I'm jumping ahead. I might go back now, but maybe this helps. So this is the kinematical map again. And so what you are choosing is which is your viewing angle across this, basically. This is the residuals of the projection. Maybe that did not help much. But basically, you have your galaxy, you can rotate it like that first and then incline it, or you can rotate it less and then incline it. Right? It's not the inclination, but it's the viewing angle of that simulated galaxy.
Is there a bar or anything?
Right. It's not exactly a bar, but there is. So the difference of these things can only be explained by non-circular motions that are typically associated with the presence of a bar. But there is no bar if you just look at the galaxy. It's just the flow of the gas. It has some sort of m equal 2 component that the tilted ring model cannot really model.
Because you're explicitly assuming,
because you assume exactly that there is no radial motion. So they show here that the model actually does a good job in recovering the parameters. So it was inclined by 60 degrees, and this is what the model gets, right, from the tilted ring model, which is within a couple of degrees. The same with the position angle, the same with the velocity dispersion over here, and the pressure corrections. So the model is okay, but it fails at reproducing or allowing this motion that is not really circular. And let me see if I can explain this. So once you have your tilted ring model, you can then subtract from your map the average velocity, right, in each pixel. And these are the residuals of that exercise. And so if your model was perfect, you should get something that has no structure in here. They go on decomposing. Now you can choose a radius and decompose these amplitudes. The red and the blue are delta in velocities with respect to your model. And what you get is something that looks like this. It's oscillations that you can decompose into a mean, a mode zero, which is the center velocity kind of thing, and then an m equal 1 and an m equal 2 to give you what it does. And what they say is that an m equal 2 mode in projection, the characteristic of that, is a three-peak curve in this sort of space. Now the question is, well, this is easy because then you can go and do this in the observed galaxies and sort of subtract the ones that you find this feature. But they go on and arguing that actually the problem is that it is not easy to detect because the tilted ring model minimizes residuals. So it will sort of correct itself, whatever three parameter it has, inclination, position angle, whatever, in order to minimize your residuals, and then you will obscure this feature. So that's why it doesn't jump up.
So it's actually a two-peak, right? It's an m.
It's two peaks.
Oh, sorry, it's a two-peak, yeah.
Yeah, and the right-hand side is the same as the left.
Right,
side.
Right. This one is, it's an m.
And then it's actually two-peak, that's the whole point.
Yeah.
But you can clearly see in the residual map above that it's not an M2 structure. It has structural normal harmonics up to M2.
Exactly.
Or something, right?
Right. Yeah.
So how might you trust this?
Pretty strong if it was too there.
Right.
Yeah.
But I can see a clear
point. Right. So then the idea is, so they put these lines over here to say if your viewing angle was across this red line, then you would be seeing the excess of velocity, so you get something that is steeper than your true circular velocity. But if you're looking across a sort of a blue line like this one, you will see dips, and then you will infer a rotation velocity that is actually smaller than your circular velocity.
With tilted ring, isn't the tilted ring right quadruple to zero?
Tries.
So the figure that's still a whole term here means that this is not the optimal tilted ring fit.
No. I think it's domestic.
The real data fits. So the real data can't be fit by tilted ring.
Exactly.
Right.
It's just not a good, right.
It's not going to know tilted ring model.
Exactly. So it minimizes the residuals, but cannot make them disappear because it's just not a good fit. Right? So this is.
But the quadruple term should disappear.
No.
Well, but see, if you average, as the dotted line, dashed line apparently is doing, mm-hmm. you take out as much as possible the quadruple. But I mean, it's there.
Yeah.
It's just
that it just flows in the gas, yeah.
Well, the tilted, on a tilted ring, when you tilt it, it's an ellipse, right? Then you have a very well-defined pattern around the ellipse. So if the real pattern doesn't fit, it's good.
Right.
Just I understand. I understand.
But my residual cannot be. But it's a low one. To make an error in my.
This is the lowest order which can survive.
Yes, this is the lowest order that can survive. That's right.
In the model, it's a simulation, so they know the history, so they presumably know where these radial motions are coming from. What is
they
that?
They didn't go into it. They didn't really, but I think it's partially all these supernovae explosions and the flows of gas that are coming through actuality in the halos, all kind of things. But they didn't really go into finding the exact reason for this.
But if it's really like this, I mean, then you should be able to detect some observations.
And then so they said it's difficult.
Yeah, because this, I mean, I don't know what this, what the resolution is and what the feedback prescriptions are, and right, you could be skeptical, right, to some extent with this result. In the simulation,
but it's sort of dynamic. It may not be the right dynamics, but it's dynamically consistent, right? So it doesn't have to be the right feedback physics, but all these things go around following you.
But I'm just saying, because, I mean, the strengths of this effect, right?
Of course, yeah. So the issue is whether when you look at the real data, whether you see its effects at the same size.
If it's not as strong, then this whole explanation is just...
Well, another diagnostic is you'll see big differences between the gas velocities and the stellar velocities.
Probably.
No, but in the simulation, they can easily measure those things. Did they discuss that?
No, really. I think this was really going towards what the observers do. This is an effort to try to do exactly the same thing that the observers do, and they don't really have velocity dispersions for the stars for these
worlds. Well, no, there was this. There are several cases where atoms.
For some of them exist. Yeah, correct.
The results were strikingly different from the earlier measurements for the gas.
Correct.
At least a few cases.
Absolutely. But this is mostly comparing with the little things.
This kind of thing could be a real problem.
That helps, right? If you also have the stars, like Nidia has, then you have a better handle on the potential because you have two different traces.
Right.
But for most of our estimates of circular velocity comes only from H1 H alpha.
The problem that you mentioned about the tilted ring taking most of that out, I mean, that's easily solved by some regularization. And you're not allowing every tilted ring to just be, but there has to be some smoothness to the,
absolutely,
to
but
the variation.
Correct. In the ring. But I think if you just apply it, as probably most a lot of the observers do.
But this used by Lola, which is the standard Lola. And they use the same regularization as the Lola people, so they just took it.
Models. So right, as Simon was saying, the ultimate goal is to apply this to real galaxies, and they say they took two that are the ones that work the best, of course, but it's a good proof of concept. So this is DDO-47 and DDO-87, which are the maps all over there. You can see over here the residuals after applying the tilted ring model. You can already see some structure. And then, so the reason of why there are more peaks here, it had to do with projection, I think, but I don't remember too well.
It's not m equals 2.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Okay. So
m equals 1, and then there's apparently an m equals whatever that is, 3 or something.
Yeah, an m equals 3 mode.
All right. There is an m equals 3 mode. Right. So this is more complex, even. Yeah. Correct? So an m equals 2 would not describe it. But the thing is, there is a residual component that clearly we are not accounting for when we use.
What are the values? I mean, here I don't really read it, but it's like
5 kilometers
a second.
And this is 5.
Example, right, the other example.
Correct. But these ones are rotating,
Well, that's 25.
All right.
These are lower mass dwarfs. This is 25. This is 20, I think.
No, but that's the full velocity without subtracting the total ring one.
Well, that's the residual.
Residual is small, but the rotation velocity of this galaxy is also smaller than the cases they were looking before. Okay.
Oh yeah, I guess you have to read it as a percentage of the amplitude in the top one.
Right. So this is rotating to 25 kilometers per second and has perturbations of order 5. And this one is 20 perturbations of order 10 or 9 kilometers per second. So it can become quite important.
This technique has been used, people use this in the Milky Way to map out structure like that when you go around.
Okay.
How do you call it? oscillations, not the ring, not a warp, but the variation of the positioning of the warp with radio.
Oh, with angle, right.
Like Leo Bliss is doing some really cool work on that. We can reach proper structure VH1 distance.
Just to see the...
And they can see structural, just, I don't know, how many harmonics, which is really scary.
What deviations from circular motion. Good, so there are at least some indications that at least some of the dwarfs might be suffering this problem, and a lot of the things that we claim to be coarse might need a revision of it. All right, so they tried to be subtle on that. It was quite non-Julio, or not yet. Well, and so the last thing that they did is coming back to this problem. Oh, I did not explain it correctly before. So this diversity, sorry, when they presented the original paper on the diversity of these rotation curves, a way of quantifying this is if you were to measure the velocity at an inner region, for example, 2 kpc, and compare it with the outer velocity. That would give you something with a lot of scatter if you have this diversity in the shape of the rotation curves, which back then looked like so, which is this over here. This is the Vmax of the measured rotation curves. This is the circular velocity at 2 kpc. And what you can see is that the observations have a lot of scatter, but if you just take an NFW, or actually no, this is cosmological simulations within CDM, it gives you this red band that is much tighter. So well, all the problems through. So they now make an evaluation of the same plot, Vmax, V2 kpc, but now instead of measuring the real circular velocity of the simulations, they use a rotation recovered through the tilted ring modeling. And so that is the dark dots over here. So if you use the real potential, you fall in this red and very tight region. But if you sort of mimic the observations, then you actually can explain most of the observations, which I found was kind of cool.
It looks worse than the observations on average.
Yeah, well, I don't know. They have one blue over there, one blue over there. They kind of span the same, similar range, at least for this very narrow region. So it's quite an interesting work. It's a very careful comparison with observations, which is welcome, I guess, in the field.
There was one other point you didn't mention. In this particular simulation, all the halos do have cusps.
Oh, right. So, well, the fact that they fall in this red region, that means they are perfect NFWs, right?
No, but, not necessarily, but they can actually measure the diamond profile.
Right. So all of the profiles...
Because the feedback is not violent enough to cause the changes in this particular recipes.
They do have the right stellar content, though, and gaseous content and right sizes. So they are consistent.
So it really depends exactly how you put the stuff
in. Yeah, it's in the modeling of the feedback. Right, so yeah, it's this, right? So all the true circular velocities will look like cuspy, and then depending on the angle that you choose to observe these galaxies, you can get things that look like cores. So in that case, so this particular galaxy might be one of the ones that in here appear down there.
So has anybody come up with a better model that'll take in the high order perturbations to the dynamics?
I think some people, for very isolated cases, they have done it, but it has not become widely spread in the community yet. So I guess the hope is that this could sprout some sort of analysis like that.
The one issue is you actually look at the images of these things, they usually look like a real mess.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really inspire you to make any very regular model.
Yeah. You can fit any holes, yeah.
So then the vertical scatter in this relation is an important constraint because there are other simulations with stronger feedback that form cores.
Right.
True cores in density. And then if you take these effects into account, you may produce even more scatter than is consistent with observations. And then taking the whole sample could be a useful way of constraining.
Actually, that plot's in the other paper. So you can see that at least the existing ones at the time of the other paper.
Well, I think a postal never had strong feedback.
No, so but all simulations which do have the bottom right panel here.
It's here.
These are all the ones where people have been claiming cores.
Right.
So you can see the scatter, at least by the simulation up to this point, was smaller amount of scatter.
Yeah.
So these effects would lead to would overwhelm the intrinsic scatter that sits.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, these effects are bigger than the effect produced by the cause produced in the single
in those cause.
So then
cause.
we can learn nothing from this.
If this would be correct.
Well, the other thing that is interesting with respect. The other thing interesting to notice with this, so this bionic explanation of the cores formed by feedback, such models are incapable to explain things like this galaxy, which core size is 8 kpc. This modification of the shape of the dark matter halo happens only where the stars are depositing the energy. And so that would happen somewhere here for this galaxy. Well, it is.
Well, this is logic.
I can do something in the center, deposit energy.
It has been measured.
Drive my
a little bit bigger.
My core out.
But it doesn't happen. Yeah.
And it's actually bigger than the optical size of the galaxy.
It's like 5 RE, and that.
If I do it with a large enough boom, then I can really.
Well, let's say if you take the simulations out there that have reproduced cores and stuff, they cannot.
That's true. But I can make.
You can make a crazy model, maybe. But not the models out there that claim to form this.
But wouldn't you have to have a lot of stellar mass?
No, we're going to blow out above the mass.
You're not going to blow out the stars.
No.
So you're blowing out the gas, but in order to do that.
You have a huge event at the beginning, which makes the enormous core about mass, and then that forms the gas out of the galaxy.
But saying this is impossible is not true. It's highly contrived.
Very difficult to get. Right. So the sizes of this course are very difficult to explain.
I have another question. Something puzzled about it. Can you show me the comparison where they show the tilted ring in the
for the
models versus the actual?
Right.
Yeah. So. If you have non-circular motions, true, indeed, the recovered rotation velocity will not reflect the circular velocity. But I would expect to recover the observed rotation velocity, because if all my modifications are just higher-order harmonics, these are orthonormal, that should not affect my ability to recover the quadruple moment, the actual rotation velocity. So, if I just add higher order harmonics to this stuff, I should still be able to, my V cosine I term should still be the same, right? So why am I having a huge bias between the blue line there and the gray curve? I understand that I don't recover the black curve, but shouldn't I recover the gray curve?
The gray curve? It's not in the assumption.
Harmonics should be orthonormal feature, orthonormal.
True velocities can be slowed by getting the wrong inclination. And then, so if you had the correct inclination, then the electricity,
the inclination,
the genes equations, it would appear as an effect of velocity dispersion. Your velocity dispersion is only with respect to your tilted ring model, so it should have a larger velocity dispersion in there.
But am I constraining the inclination just by looking at the?
I don't know how these codes do that actually.
But they get the inclination right. But so I think what it is that you're fitting your velocities only sort of along the edges of the sort. You're not fitting the velocity all the way around the ring because of projection effects. So
you get the entire curve.
That's when you get the map.
Yeah, that curve that you show, and you get that. Then you first fit it with that thing, and then the other things, which is a higher order one. So you didn't think later on.
They're fitting the full 2D image, so in principle they are fitting all the way around the ring. That's actually what we use to get the information.
Yeah, but effectively you're not getting the rotation velocity. When it goes across your line of sight, you're not getting the rotation velocity.
But if you have an inclination of 60 degrees, then you know you should. It should be a circular velocity on an ellipse with a 2-to-1 axis ratio.
Yeah.
And you know it's 2-to-1 axis ratio because you can see that from the surface densities. And then you know how things should vary with azimuths around this, and then you fit that, and that gives you the velocity. So you're using the velocity all the way around this ellipse.
And so if you go back to the one where you show the actual curve.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, or actually the one where you
show the observed ones?
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Because the only thing that was different between the two cases was the orientation angle.
indelicate.
The orientation angle translates just in a phase difference.
So this is the observation.
That d minus of a curve. And that should not affect it. Why would that
affect?
These are the observations. But they had a red curve and a blue curve. They were just a different orientation angle. Right? Mm-hmm. And that just is a different phase along that curve. It just changes all the phases.
Well, how do we know what one of these looks like in a different angle?
Yeah.
No, we don't. But what I'm saying is in the simulation one, they had two curves, a red curve and a blue curve. And the only one was whether I look from here or whether I look from here.
Right.
And that should translate only in a difference in that phase. In other words, this point now comes out to be on top, and then.
It's a different angle, but the same inclination. And then you perform the inclination after. That's the main issue, right?
Right.
I mean, everything which looks different from the standard kind of fish curve, whatever you call it. Has to be taken up by the model by changing the tilt and the wings. Anything like this, which is irregular, it's going to do this in a complicated way. So I don't think you can argue easily what's going to happen.
And clearly, doesn't it? That's what it shows. Indeed, these things are not orthonormal. And tilted ring model makes it actually.
Yeah, at least in this small scale, yeah. Okay, cool.
Thank you.